All right, thanks very much, Ryan Burrow. Steve Bertrand here. It's the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN. And as you heard Ryan and Steve say, we start the program amidst word of a deal for a two-year spending plan, at least out of the Senate. That's going on. The stock market is all over the place again today. We'll talk to Terry Savage about that a little bit later in the program. We're going to talk to Dan Cox, who is a writer for 538. I don't know if you follow 538. They're always looking at numbers, percentages, and things like that. They had a piece last week about religion and who follows which religion, and some pretty dramatic numbers when it comes to younger Americans, especially when it comes to young evangelicals. So I just thought it was interesting, and certainly applies to business and marketing and all of that. So we'll talk to Dan Cox about that in the second half hour, and Dick Burke as well, the CEO of Envoy. But we start by looking at Wall Street. Terry Savage is on a phone line. Terry, another one of those days where it's been all over the place, down 100, up 300. Right now we're up about 102.
Yeah, the best word to ordinary investors is stay out of the way, because you're going to get whipsawed, you're going to get crushed, the elephants are rampaging. This is not about interest rates. It is not about the economy. It is not about oil prices. All those are making headlines of their own. And this is not about what the president thinks should happen. What this is about is internal market structure things, some incredible bullish months of trading, and some investors, traders, big names that hedged their position in a way that counted on low volatility remaining. And then when that volatility started to spike, those positions showed losses. There were forced margin sales overnight. Panic went around the world, of course. And so we have forced sales and then purchases to even out the positions. None of this has anything to do with anything but the market, except that it's your money. And if you make the wrong move, you will lose money.
I love the dancing around who's responsible or who gets credit and all of that this week. Because, you know, President Trump and the stock market has soared under President Trump. And he likes to point that out, that it's done well. And he brings it up, says he's not getting enough credit for that. And so when we had the big dive on Monday, all the president's opponents were saying, oh, look at that. He lived by the sword. Now he's going to die by the sword. Now, those people have egg on their face because it's going to almost all be made up in a matter of days. Go ahead.
Well, anybody who believes that the president can or should take credit, the president can take a certain amount of credit for the economy, a lot of which was put into place 6, 7, 8 years ago. I mean, I didn't like it when President Obama took credit for some things that were done beforehand. I don't think any president should take credit. I think the world should give our executive officers and our Congress credit when they do the right things, and the market does that by voting with its dollars. So it's sort of ridiculous to even comment on whether, I mean, there's a lot ridiculous in Washington to give the president any credit for the stock market.
Well, one more then, and I think I know your answer to this one, but the president said earlier today, quote, in the old days, when good news was reported, the stock market would go up. This was a tweet. Today, when good news is reported, the stock market goes down. Big mistake, and we have so much good, great news about the economy.
Well, look, first of all, that's not true. There have been plenty of times when the stock market has gone down on good news. In fact, almost every bear market I can think of, and I've lived through a few now, has started when the economic news was great. In 73, I mean, the Dow was moving. The Dow was over 1,000. Nobody could see a bear market on the horizon that took the market down 50%. And how about in 2000? I mean, I remember being around saying, wait a minute, this is crazy. Oh, no, the dot-com is going to change the world. Technology is changing the world. The Internet is. In fact, it did change the world, and the economy looked great. And pow, the stock market went down. In fact, markets go down when everybody's so optimistic about the economy that they've poured money into the market, which has happened in the last few months especially, and nobody's left to buy. Someone says sell, and there's a vacuum.
Well, stocks certainly have gone up since the tax bill was signed by the president, and there's a study out by Birney Associates.
Laszlo Birney, yes.
Okay. And they looked at the buybacks, the percentage of stock buybacks. They say companies have announced so far this year $88.6 billion in buybacks of their own stock. It was $40 billion last year, so more than double. Okay, I look at that and I say they're taking their money, and rather than investing in research or investing in their own infrastructure or investing in their workers, they're putting the money back in to pump up their own stock value, which is not the sort of thing I think is a great way to spend this money. However, maybe there's so much new money going into these companies that $88.6 billion isn't that big of a deal. I mean, I wonder what you think about that.
Exactly. It's a relative thing. First of all, from a year ago, corporations have had some pretty terrific earnings. So even without the tax cut, corporations have had record profits, and a corporation has three choices what to do with the money. The first is it could pay a dividend to shareholders. That's ordinary income. Shareholders like it. The second thing they can do is, right, open a new plant, buy some new equipment, and believe me, you're going to see a lot of that because the incentives created under the new tax law. So it only makes smart corporate management, where it makes sense and it could be profitable, to reinvest in growing the business. And you're right. The third thing is they can use the money, and if a company earns X many dollars and there's only 80% of the shares outstanding that there were last year, then the earnings per share get pumped up. Now, everybody understands that that's a market technician, so nobody gets surprised when a company's earnings per share go up because there are fewer shares outstanding. That only boosts the stock in the sense that people go, not only are there fewer shares and more earnings per share, but there's incremental earnings because they're growing and they're having more profits. The world is not that naive to think that a stock should just go up because the earnings per share number was artificially boosted by a buyback.
That's Terry Savage. We're going to take a break. I want to come back, ask her about the budget deal, and also she's got a website for you to help you manage your own money, whether the Congress can manage theirs or not. Well, I guess that's yours too. It's 12:23. This is the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN. Terry Savage on a phone line. Okay, Terry, I want to talk about Acorns, the website that you were suggesting, but let's touch on this budget deal. It's coming out of the Senate. McConnell and Schumer have announced it on the floor of the Senate, and it's a 2-year spending plan. It increases spending, but it does not include the Dreamers, the DACA kids. And I think I heard Ryan Burrow say earlier today that Nancy Pelosi was speaking on the floor of the House for 2 hours about these Dreamers. So I don't know how things are going to fly at the House. But what do you make of all of this so far?
So I'm actually as concerned about the DACA issue, the immigration issue, and many other issues. But however, I think that to pull an end around the Democrats and the Republicans getting together to deprive the president of his hoped-for stalemate that gives him more power is a most positive thing I've seen come out of the Congress. I hope they can get their recalcitrant members on both sides to agree to a 2-year budget. If that happens, we will have a chance to see if tax cuts, which I believe they will, really work. And instead of borrowing more money, we wind up borrowing less because we get increased receipts from growth in businesses and individuals getting jobs and working and getting raises.
I know the right doesn't like it so much in the House.
The left doesn't like it.
Exactly. So maybe in this case,
but
the middle.
Maybe we can leave the argument no longer be about the economy and money and growth, and then Congress can sit down and have serious discussions and come to some equally good resolutions of other troubling problems. They have done is snatched victory from the jaws of the president, who is looking to profit himself. I believe, my opinion, that he's looking to empower himself from the discord in Congress. I think they were statesmen of the first order to come up with the 2-year budget deal, and I hope it passes.
And my point was that perhaps the middle will come together on this. Okay, so
exactly. You
write at terrysavage.com your latest column about Acorns, which I know is a money-saving plan, right? But they can also teach financial education, or what's up here?
I'm excited about this. I know we have a couple of minutes. Acorns is an app, or you can go to acorns.com to read about it. I've written about it, started 4 or 5 years ago, one of my favorite apps. You register your credit cards and debit cards in your bank account, and every time you buy something, gas at the pump or groceries or whatever it is, if your bill was $11.82, they round it up to $12, and that extra 18 cents gets put into a little account there. And whenever you get $5, they roll it out and put it into an investment fund created by a Nobel Prize winning economist, either conservative, aggressive, or moderate. It's just a way of taking your spare change, that piggy bank thing, and making it go to work immediately. And they've got 2.9 million users. So they realized they had a lot of people who were getting into investing this way and didn't understand a lot about budgeting and money management. Obviously, our schools have failed us. it's been my lifelong cause. When I saw that Acorns created a terrific online personal finance tutorial, I really am happy to recommend it. You can find out more at acorns.com, or you can sign up for the course about $11.99. If you're a high school student, never took personal finance, if you're person you're dating doesn't understand about budgeting, if you argue with your spouse about money, this is the course for you. Go to terrysavage.com. You'll see the link.
I read the column, and I saw you suggest that couples fighting over money go to this. This will scare.
Oh, yes, because you'll find a common ground, and it's well done. Great gal, Jennifer Barrett, is the face of it. She's a former CNBC personal finance editor. But I love to see that, you know, I wrote books. I don't think you can give your kids books anymore, even though I say to them, just have them read the first 70 pages of The Savage Truth on Money. They're not doing that anymore, and I'm just thrilled to see a really accessible course with worksheets you can download. Every high school should use that particular, it's already done. Make that your curriculum for your high school kids.
All right, check it out. It's at terrysavage.com, but it's Acorns, right? That Acorns is
Acorns. You'll see a column on the left. It says Acorns Financial Apps. And when you do, in the bottom, there's a link. That's, I think it's $11.99, and it's really a worthwhile thing.
All right, we'll talk again next week, Terry.
Absolutely.
Thanks very much, Kim Gordon. Steve Bertrand here. It's 12:36. This is the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN. All right, just about every issue they're talking in Washington today. In fact, Nancy Pelosi was on the floor of the House for a couple of hours, Ryan said earlier, pushing for immigration reform. Immigration is everywhere, and no one knows that better than Dick Burke. He's the CEO of Envoy and is making a return stop to the business lunch. Dick, welcome back.
Great to be here, Steve. Thank you for having me. Very timely times.
Yeah, well, it seems like it always is.
Yes.
And I'm always fascinated to talk to you because you come at this from a business angle.
Yes, sir.
And so let's just start with Envoy. Tell me what Envoy is and what it does.
Sure. We are a Chicago-based company, Steve, and we do two things. We help companies hire a global workforce, which means procuring for them the necessary work authorization, whether that's in the United States or overseas. And the second thing we do is we help you manage that global workforce, keeping track of renewal dates, expiration dates, conflicts, particularly important now in the current administration, where they are looking for any type of infraction to potentially send someone back home.
Is it not something that a company could do on its own?
Certain companies do it on their own, but we find it's generally not in their core area of expertise.
Right.
They should focus on what they're expert at, and what we, in turn, are expert at are those two things, securing the work authorization and managing the foreign employees so that they don't end up unwittingly out of compliance and needing to go home.
That's a really good point because that happens quite a bit, doesn't it? We just heard about a case in the Skokie courthouse where a kid was pulled out because he wasn't strictly in compliance.
Exactly. And the best analogy I've heard, Steve, is, you know, in the old days you could drive 60 in a 55 zone and probably not get pulled over. There's a new sheriff in town, and if you're going 56, they're going to pull you over.
Right.
And we're seeing that in all sorts of ways. Increased site visits, increased audits. So our ability to, Envoy's ability to help companies manage that, whether you're consciously or unconsciously out of compliance, real value.
Okay, that's their business. Let's talk about your business for a sec. You got a little more money in the account.
We did, thanks. We not easy raising money with this current administration, but we're growing nicely. So we raised $20 million back in October from a great growth equity fund out of New York City called Catalyst Investors, and they've been a terrific partner. They're quite a bit of experience helping HR technology companies, so really excited about that. And
what do you do with that money? How does that grow?
Sure. It will fund continued development into our sales force. We're seeing really nice growth, and we now believe if we add more salespeople, we'll accelerate that. More investment into technology. We have hands down the best technology platform, but we think there are ways we can really make it incredibly helpful to our customers. That, and then third, if interesting acquisition opportunities come along, we'll be prepared.
Break the news here, will you, when it happens?
I'm sorry?
You can come here and break the news.
I always enjoy being with you, Steve.
Okay, so the president is all about the economy and growing the economy, is predicting, you know, 4 and 5% economic growth. Explain to him why more immigrants are better for growing the economy than fewer immigrants.
Great, great question, because if the administration has a business mantra, one of them would be this 4% GDP growth. And the second, let's lighten up on the regulatory scheme so these companies can grow. The one area counter to that is immigration. And it's very, very unfortunate because the facts are demonstrably clear that immigration helps companies grow and helps the country grow. They add to the economy as consumers and as buyers. They fill jobs that will not otherwise be filled. They drive innovation. They drive patent creation. They drive STEM developments. Think of what our country would be like if we didn't have an Elon Musk or a Sergey Brin as an immigrant. Think of the jobs creation, the pride we all felt yesterday when we saw that SpaceX rocket go up.
That was very cool, wasn't it? Awesome. I mean, it was just an amazing thing.
Amazing.
There's a study, I think it was from Price Waterhouse. Actually, you wrote about this in The Hill.
Yeah.
Almost 80% of employers are looking to expand, but they're worried about finding the talent to do it.
That is exactly right. That's exactly right. And we're here. We just released a study earlier this morning, so that's why we're so thrilled to be here just a few hours after it's released. Went out to 400 HR professionals across the country, all sorts of geography, all sorts of industries, and the three or four big headlines. Number one, demand is unabated. It's increasing, in fact. So even notwithstanding the administration, which is trying to slow things down,
right.
Demand for foreign-born talent is up on a year-over-year basis. And secondly, we ask people, do you expect your foreign-born headcount to increase or decrease? By a scale of 4 to 1, they expect an increase.
So does that mean that the rhetoric and the tightening from the administration isn't having an impact?
Well, it seems to it's hard to understand. I think the reality is it's not having an impact. And people are realizing that, hey, listen, we want to grow. We want to contribute to this 4% growth. But we can't do it if we can't get the right workers in. The unemployment rate for people with a college degree is close to 2% now. The U.S. Department of Labor, their own statistics show about 2 million unfilled STEM jobs by next year. So we need to get these positions filled.
All right. I want to look at that from two different directions. One is external and well, the other is internal in a way, I guess. The STEM jobs aren't, the STEM workers aren't here, or there's concern about immigration. Mm-hmm. And you also wrote in that piece that I think it's 20% of companies are already looking to expand overseas because they can't get the workers here.
That is exactly right.
So would they stay here if they could get those foreign workers
here?
Yes,
they'd prefer to. It's much easier to manage people in your own backyard than overseas, where you've got cultural issues, you've got a whole new regulatory and legal landscape, you've got time zone issues. They'd rather do it here, but they're saying about 22%, constant with last year, that if we can't get the workers in, we will send it overseas. One of our bigger clients is a West Coast-based consumer goods company. I don't want to identify them by name. We've all heard of them, and they went down to Mexico where they can get quality workers because they said it's just too difficult to bring them in to California where they're based.
So they're doing business in Mexico because the workers are there.
Yes.
The skilled workers.
Yes.
Are other countries doing that, or are other countries trying to
other
move in on their...
Other countries are doing it. China is doing it. They have liberalized their immigration rules, trying to get the same foreign talent we are getting, principally from India and the Philippines. Canada has been in the popular press for doing the exact same thing. So they are competing for us for this talent, and we know these people are job creators.
Right.
So query, what is the wisdom of saying, you know, we're going to close the door to that? We need to have a debate that separates this, you know, the fire from the smoke, and the reality is, let's be safe. We can have all sorts of security protocols, but don't ignore the fact that we need these people to help create jobs and to be consumers.
I want to get to my other point, but you brought something up there. How safe are these workers?
Well,
explain that, what they go through, because I think this, you know, sometimes the implication from the White House and elsewhere is that it's willy-nilly. Well, it's a lottery. It's by chance.
Well, the suggestion even in the State of the Union is there's just this open screen door, right, that people, not even a door, you just flood right through. There is very significant vetting that goes on to get an H-1B visa, to get a green card. All sorts of checks are going on. Do we need to tighten those more? Perhaps. I've not seen any thoughtful discussion on what the additional scrutiny would be. But
you have to find another place to look, right? Yeah, they're already looking everywhere.
They're looking everywhere. And the statistics bear this out. Namely, crimes that are committed by foreign-born are a fraction of what crimes of U.S.-born citizens are. So again, we need to have a conversation that backs off on the rhetoric, focuses on the facts, and realizes this can be a win-win. We can increase safety and we can drive this 4%.
Okay, so that's companies chasing foreign workers. The other part are the foreign workers who are coming here to be educated.
Yes.
They're getting their STEM degrees, and then we're kind of chasing them out.
Yeah, we can't give them. One of the initiatives of the administration is to reduce the ability and the amount of time that recent college grads can stick around. It's called the OPT STEM program, to stick around until they can latch onto a company and get. What is the wisdom of that? We bring them in, we educate them, and then send them back to every other country to compete with us. There's no wisdom in that.
We were talking off the air about it, and we've just got a few seconds left, but chain migration.
Yes.
And that's extended family members.
Yes.
Does that have any role in this?
It does. And chain is, unfortunately, a pejorative term. It's really family members. And you need to think about is that when people want to come over, depending on where they are in their life, they may want to bring a spouse, if they have it, or certainly children. Which would be allowed now. The Trump administration is attempting to curtail the spouse's ability to work. Obama put through a program called the H-4 visa, Steve, which allows the spouse to work. The Trump administration has proposed taking that away. Then you're putting these foreign nationals in a position, well, I can come here, but my spouse isn't going to be able to work. How's that going to go over at home, and can we make ends meet that way? So the treatment of family members, firstly spouse, then children, and then extended, needs to be factored in the equation. Will those people be able to work? Will they also be able to get green cards? I understand the need to limit it, but we think that there's a both and. You can attract the best talent and draw the line around the family at a logical place.
Dick Burke is the CEO of Envoy. I love when you come in. Nice to talk to you and look forward to the next time.
Well, thank you for having me. Love being here. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Steve Alexander. Steve Bertrand here. It's the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN. John Williams coming up in just a few minutes. Before that, I want to talk to Dan Cox. He is a writer at 538. And we'll start with a stat. The number from 2006, the number of white evangelical Protestants in the country was 26% in 2006. In 2016, that number had dropped to 17%. And it is a number that apparently continues to go down, particularly when you talk to younger people. Dan Cox on a phone line now. Dan, welcome to the Wintrust Business Lunch.
Thanks for having me.
You know, this is a business show, and sometimes I try to find a topic that I'm really interested in and figure out the business angle. I love the demographics of this, the topic of it, and I suppose it comes when it comes to marketing or to assigning business factors to populations. This is relevant, but I'm just interested in this de-religionizing. That's certainly not a word, but it seems like that's what's happening in this country. I mean, what do you take away from this article you put together?
Yeah, so it's really a snapshot of a larger trend that we've been watching for some time. Since the early 1990s, we've seen the number of people who don't identify with any particular religion, we identify them as religiously unaffiliated, has been increasing fairly dramatically from about 6 or 7% of the adult population at that time to roughly a quarter of the population currently. We're seeing a 3- to 4-fold increase in people who aren't identifying with religion, and this is something new. We haven't seen this before. The data that we have goes back from a variety of data sets to the early 70s, and so this is the first time we're seeing this really significant increase. And the piece I wrote for 538, it focused on a group that was thought to be relatively immune from these sort of larger religious disaffiliation forces. So white evangelical Protestants and other conservative religious traditions were thought to be relatively safe from the sort of the shifts that had been occurring.
The idea being that they're a little more fervent in their beliefs and that they would not likely move away from them.
Exactly, that the sort of the consistent strict theology kept people coming back. That because those churches were asking more of their members stayed committed to the faith. But what we're seeing is that basically across the board, whether you're talking about white Catholics, white mainland Protestants, or white evangelicals, those numbers are all slipping.
So the headline, I think, was the white evangelicals. So they have dropped now. If you look at the percentage of white evangelicals in America, 8% ages 8 to 29, 26% 65 and older. So clearly the older population carrying the younger. In the Catholic, white Catholic category, I think was it maybe more surprising to me. I mean, you have 8% evangelical Protestant, 18 to 29, but only 6% Catholic. It looks to me like maybe they're losing their numbers more than the others.
Right. And what's going on, there's two different things going on. One is that the nation overall is becoming less white. This is something that demographers have been telling us for some time. It's sort of glacial in its pace, so it's not happening overnight. But a part of the story is that, the overall white population is contracting, and so we're seeing white religious groups contracting
as well. I'm glad you brought that up, too, because you have other groups, including Hispanic, Catholic, Hispanic Protestant, Black Protestant, and such as that. We're looking at white people only in these numbers.
Right, exactly. But it's still the larger part of the story is that people are disaffiliating. So we're seeing declines basically across the board in almost every major religious tradition. And that's the sort of the new thing that we're trying to keep track of.
So is this just the U.S. lagging behind Europe? I mean, did Europe go through this 20, 30 years ago?
Yeah, so that's a question that I think folks have been puzzling over for some time is, are we seeing secularization in the U.S. That is just, 20, 30 years late from what we've seen in a lot of Western Europe? And my sense of it, looking at the data and studying this stuff, is that, America continues to be exceptional. So we're sort of following a different path, and it may take us to a different place. Currently we are seeing religious declines. But it may be that there's a stabilizing point or a point at which this slows down. And the U.S. at this point remains a very religiously observant country, despite the fact that we've seen these really significant declines.
So you refer to a generational shift and, changes from generation to generation, which I would imagine goes back through the generations. But maybe it doesn't, because if it was going back through the generations, we'd be out of religious by now.
Right. And one of the really interesting theories that has been upended recently is this idea that young people are less religious, and as they get older, they become more religious.
Uh-huh.
But this generation is not really following that same trend. So, for instance, young people today who are unaffiliated or not religious are much more likely to marry someone who's also not religious. So they're sort of starting non-religious families and bringing up children outside the church or outside a place of worship. And so you have young people who are raised kind of nothing in terms of religion, staying that way through the course of their life. And that's, again, that's something that's new.
And then their kids are not going to have a church ever to go back to because they never would have had a church to start with.
Right. So there's been so much attention on trying to win back people who've left, but there's a whole group of people who've never been religious and will probably require a very different message to appeal to.
All right. So what do the churches or what do business leaders, what does anyone do with these numbers?
That's a good question. I mean, other than sort of scratch your head and throw your hands up in the air, I mean, I think it's really a difficult conundrum for a lot of these religious institutions who are sort of facing this dramatic cultural change that we're living through on a whole range of stuff. I talked about homosexuality and same-sex marriage, but really the entire sort of feeling about sexual morality, whether that's divorce, different types of family arrangements, we're seeing a sea change.
I think you're so right. I think you look at gay marriage. I mean, that happened in hyperspeed when it comes to a lot of other cultural shifts. Dan Cox, a writer for 538. Love talking to you. Hope we can do it again.
Absolutely. My pleasure.
It's the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN.